So my guest today is Stephen McNamara. Stephen is a visiting professor of law at the University of Florida School of Law. He's also an associate professor at the American University of Beirut. Stephen was once upon a time a corporate lawyer. He's now an academic lawyer with interests in moral theory, business ethics, and technological change in financial markets. He also once upon a time did a PhD in philosophy and wrote a dissertation on Kant's use of Newtonian scientific method. So welcome to the show, Stephen.
John, it's great to be here.
So Stephen, we're going to talk today about some of the work you've been doing on the ethics of automated trading platforms and financial markets. In particular, we're going to discuss some of the ideas and arguments in a paper you wrote entitled The Law and Ethics of High-Frequency Trading, which I'll link to in the show notes. Now, regular listeners to this podcast will know that I recently did another interview with Michael Wellman and Uday Rajan on the uses of AI in financial trading. But I'm hoping this conversation won't overlap too much with that previous conversation for two reasons. One is that we're going to focus specifically on high-frequency trading platforms, whereas we didn't in the previous conversation. And also, Stephen's paper is a lot more engaged with moral theory and how moral theory should apply to the design of regulation in financial markets. And I hope we can dwell on those two features of the paper in our conversation today. So let me start off with a question just about how financial markets or securities markets are structured in the US, because this has an important repercussions for how high-frequency trading systems have affected markets. Maybe you could start just talking about like the history of exchanges in the US.
Certainly. In America, our stock trading situation, it really historically traces all the way back to the 1700s. In Lower Manhattan, right where Wall Street is, there was trading on the curb on Wall Street. And out of that group of traders, ultimately, the New York Stock Exchange was formed. In America, we had stock exchanges all across the United States in major cities. I think there was about 8 or 10 or 12 regional stock exchanges, obviously with the New York Stock Exchange being the largest and the most important. But those were traditional what we call open outcry markets. And if you read about the history of Wall Street, or sometimes you'll see in movies depictions of groups of traders furiously negotiating and trading and using hand signals to trade stocks, those traders were what we call broker dealers, and they were trading on behalf of clients. They held what's called a seat on the exchange, and those were physical open outcry markets. Historically, they persisted until the early 2000s. One very interesting deviation from this was the NASDAQ, which in the 70s and 80s and 90s had more tech and startup stocks because their listing requirements were easier for startup companies to meet. NASDAQ was not an open outcry market. It was a quote-driven market where broker-dealers would put on quotes and then they would be picked up.
Could I just interject here for a moment? Maybe you could just explain that idea. Like, what's the difference between an open outcry system and a quote-based system?
Well, an open outcry system would have live human beings working as an agent for a client. So those human beings, again, were the broker dealers, and they would go to other broker dealers and try to make an exchange to consummate a trade for a client. And they also had at the New York Stock Exchange, it was what's called a specialist system, where you had trading in stocks went through specialists who would be market makers in a certain stock. So if nobody was willing to buy, the specialist, the market maker, would serve as a last resort person to buy a stock if somebody needed to sell. That was a human-driven process where you're connecting two people and making a trade for a client in the physical confines of a large trading room with many, many different posts where specialists would be located. The quote-driven system was just electronic quotes put up, and people could, you know, access those quotes and originally telephonically consummate those trades.
So with the open outcry system, you're trying to find a partner for an exchange, and it's driven by that human interaction, I guess, between the broker dealers. Whereas on the quote-based system, its prices are available, are quoted, and then you can kind of pick a price, or if you're interested in making a deal, you can proceed further with it. But it doesn't involve that sort of matching between two broker dealers, or am I getting it wrong?
Well, you're still matching, and in the open outcry system, you would have, in the old stock exchange format, they would have a ticker tape listing on the consolidated quotes, listing the best quotes, the going rate for a particular stock. So economically, it was similar, but the NASDAQ did not have individual humans in the same room making a trade.
I mean, one thing as well that you go into in your paper about this old system is just the, I guess there are certain barriers. You have to have a license, you have to be a broker dealer, and there are costs of trading involved, and those costs were quite high, and the, I guess the premiums or the rents, you might say, extracted by the dealers were quite high. So maybe you could discuss some of those features of the old system.
Yeah. Well, the broker dealers charged clients commissions. Early, they were fixed commissions, which were quite high. So, you know, when I was growing up as a kid in the 70s and 80s, you would hear, oh, somebody's dad is a stockbroker. They're fabulously wealthy. Well, why were they so wealthy? They had a lot of, you know, wealthy private clients, and they were charging them high fixed commissions. So that was one form of fee, which was quite high. The other was the spreads between buy and sell offers were fixed. They were usually fixed in 1/8 of a dollar increments. So they were usually 12.5 cents, 25 cents, 50 cents were common spreads. And that spread, the market maker typically would capture that spread. So if you were a specialist in a stock, you would make quite a bit of money capturing the spread between buying and selling particular stocks. Due to those high costs in the 90s, those were really the motives behind the push to get what we call Reg NMS. It stands for Regulation National Market System. The high fixed costs of trading was the impetus to get Reg NMS going in the 90s. And that was pushed through. It was promulgated in 2005, and it went into effect in 2007. So Reg NMS knits together all the different stock exchanges in the United States into effectively a single system. That is, we can go more into the details there, but that is our major regulatory backdrop now for stock trading. Another thing that also happened, which was very important for prices, is that stock trades at stock prices went from 1/8 increments, 1/8 of a dollar increments, to pennies in 2000. And that's what's called decimalization. That had a transformative effect as well. It both made it very difficult to make a lot of money as a market maker, and it did greatly reduce the cost of trading for institutional investors and mom and pop investors. So now if you look at most big stocks, very widely traded stocks, you'll see spreads of 1 to 5 or 8 cents between a buy and a sell offer. And before, your minimum spread would have been 12.5. So decimalization and then the push to have this regulatory revamp of the stock system, which resulted in Reg NMS, those radically changed the economics of our stock trading system.
Another factor that motivated the introduction of Reg NMS was the perceived fragmentation in the market. as well. So, I mean, the situation historically...
I would not say that. I think Reg NMS was motivated by a perception that there was not enough competition between the exchanges, but rather Reg NMS has greatly increased the amount of fragmentation in the market. And to go back here, some people in the 90s and early 2000s, when Reg NMS was being formulated, and actually dissenting commissioners on the Securities and Exchange Commission who were in opposition to Reg NMS, they were warning about the dangers of fragmentation. So prior to Reg NMS, we did not really have that fragmented a system. And I think something like 80% of stock trades were located on the New York Stock Exchange.
Right. So like in pre-Reg NMS, we had lots of different exchanges and they were operating in effectively isolation from each other, or not, like there wasn't as much kind of cross.
Yes, yeah. There wasn't. There was a consolidated tape, which if you see a movie, you know, dealing with Wall Street or finance in the pre-computer era, you know, they have the ticker tape giving you stock quotes. That consolidated tape or ticker tape, that did serve to knit together prices so things wouldn't get too far out of line, but they weren't legally mandated to trade at the best price.
Okay, but so Reg NMS has reduced that kind of isolation. You've knitted the system together into one, effectively one national marketplace. There are still the multiple different exchanges, and there's still, I guess, lots of competition then. And so there's fragmentation in that sense and increased competition, but there's reduced isolation as opposed to fragmentation.
Reduced isolation, because if you go into the specific rules of Reg NMS, the most important one, that's the order protection rule. That rule effectively knits all the markets together, because it says you can't make a trade on an exchange if the price isn't at the best price nationally.
So I think that gives us a sense then of the current landscape. I don't want to go too much into the legal details on the different components of Reg NMS. And we'll come back to any of them if they're relevant to our conversation about high frequency trading a little bit later on. But I mean, just the general sense is that we've moved from a position of isolation with high transaction costs and these high spreads to one where we have a nationalized market. There's more fragmentation and competition within that market, but there's less isolation and there's a reduction in the spreads. So
yes, that's correct. Exactly.
So let's then talk about just how technology then and algorithmic trading platforms or automated trading platforms are feeding into this new system, this new landscape. And let's just go back kind of pre-Reg NMS just to the history of algorithmic trading in general. You talk very briefly about this in the paper, but the concept of algorithmic trading is reasonably old. It's not a very new phenomenon. There are particular manifestations of it that are maybe newer and more interesting, but the core concept itself is an old one. So maybe you could just discuss some of the history behind the practice of algorithmic trading.
Yeah, as I understand this, and most of my information is a great paper by two financial economists, Andrei Kirilenko and Andrew Lowe. They wrote a paper called Moore's Law versus Murphy's Law, and they detail very effectively the development from the 70s into the present day of algorithmic trading. But it basically developed in the 70s when people realized you could, through the use of developing computer technology, you could monitor far, far more variables with the use of computers than a human being could do. So if you can simultaneously monitor 10 or 20 or 50 different variables, your ability to react immediately to different financial prices and news sources would be far, far enhanced. So that is the origin of algorithmic trading, just allowing many, many more variables than an individual human trader could continuously monitor to affect trades you're making in the market.
Yeah, I mean, like, in one sense, like within financial theory, there are certain trading strategies that are highly formalized, kind of precise mathematical rules that you have to follow to diversify your portfolio and reduce your risk exposure and so forth. And the variables that get plugged into those algorithms, the precise information that gets fed into them, that can be monitored and extracted from the market through computer technology. And so you can implement those trading strategies through automated platforms. And that's kind of the essence or the origin of this algorithmic trading practice. Now, your view, and you mentioned this briefly in the paper, is that these historical modes of algorithmic trading are not particularly ethically problematic. They're not worrisome. Could you briefly explain why that is the case?
Yeah, I think this really goes to the issue of what we think arbitrage is, and whether arbitrage itself is perceived as ethically problematic. You know, when you have a natural disaster, like here I am in Florida, when we have a hurricane, you will often have instances of price gouging, people selling power generators or other supplies at vastly inflated costs. Well, from their perspective, they're just bringing a valuable product to a market which is experiencing a sudden shortfall. I think generally, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think generally in business ethics and business, we don't think that arbitrage is fundamentally a bad thing. It's a good thing. And in financial theory, you know, it's how we get a law of one price. There should be one price between markets. If I notice something being sold at a higher price on another market and I go there to sell it, I'm actually making, in a global sense, prices more efficient. So if we're just using computer technology to do that in the financial markets, most people feel that's fine.
So if I can kind of summarize your argument in relation to these more historical methods of algorithmic trading, it's that spotting arbitrage opportunities and taking advantage of them is not intrinsically a bad thing, because in some global sense, reducing price discrepancies across markets is beneficial. It's a good thing to happen for society. Now, somebody might make a profit on the arbitrage operation itself, but yeah, globally or for at a society-wide scale, it's a good thing.
And I think that's what we see in very simple uses of algorithmic technology in the stock trading market. We don't intrinsically feel that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, but then when it comes to high-frequency trading, there are maybe some differences when it comes to the ethical assessment, because it's not just about arbitrage. So maybe start by talking about what high-frequency trading is and what's the purpose or rationale behind high-frequency trading systems. What are high-frequency traders trying to do in the market?
Simply put, they're just applying the most advanced information technology, both in terms of software and hardware, to stock trading and other forms of financial trading as well. So when we have this phrase, high-frequency trading, in essence, it's just the application of cutting-edge information technology to formerly manual or non-digitized market interactions.
My understanding of high-frequency trading, though, it's kind of a specific subset of more general algorithmic trading strategies insofar as it is particularly concerned with speed, being the first to conduct what some people refer to as a latency arbitrage.
Yes. I think I just wanted to point out definitionally, you know, it's a term that encompasses a lot of different things. But yes, this is, to back up, high frequency trading really burst into the public consciousness with the publication of Michael Lewis's book, with the publication of Flash Boys, where he was identifying how certain traders were not able to consummate trades at prices they observed on the markets. And when Brad Katsuyama, who's actually the CEO of this new stock exchange, IEX, when he tried to get to the root of this, they realized that other traders were finding out about offers and quotes that were put out and racing ahead of them to different, basically, computer servers, which are the exchanges now, making advantageous trades ahead of them or pulling quotes that would be disadvantageous away. So what was colloquially referred to as front running by Michael Lewis and others, that is the fact that high frequency traders can trade ahead of basic, mostly institutional investors with the use of various techniques.
Yeah, I mean, just to give it like a really simple analogy here to explain the concept, I mean, if you go back to the classic world of the human trader or broker-dealer, you could imagine them literally chasing across the floor of an exchange or something to consummate an exchange. So they have an offer. So they both have the same information, but the offer price, and one of them just gets there faster and is able to take advantage of the fact that they get to the other partner for exchange faster. Is that roughly an analogy
yes.
that explains the strategy underlying it? Except they're doing yes. it through information technology.
Yes.
Okay, so in a sense, they're taking advantage of a latency arbitrage. You mentioned Lewis's book. So Lewis's book kicked off a bit of a debate or furore about the practice of high frequency trading, because throughout that book he refers to the practice, or describes it as rigging the market, somehow introducing a level of unfairness to the way in which trades are conducted. Now, I mean, some people will maybe laugh at that idea insofar as they think these things are all unfair, but there's something specifically troubling about high-frequency trading, at least according to the argument within that book. So what is it about high-frequency trading that seems to motivate people to use that kind of language about rigging the market?
Yeah, I should say, at the end of the day, I'm sympathetic to that. And my paper was an attempt to try to bridge, you know, what I see as a very technocratic finance and to some extent the legal community. Some people are deeply influenced by this as well, a financial economic argument that can't understand that, to the reaction that Lewis got. I think the sense in which markets are rigged in that book, as well as Scott Patterson book, which is very interesting.
The Dark Pools is the name of that, I think.
In those two books, the rigging comes from the fact that the stock exchanges have worked, it appears, with some degree of closeness with high-frequency traders to do a couple different things. I think the most important of which would be co-location, which is to sell space in their computer facilities, whereby high-frequency traders can put their own computer servers right next to the exchange, and therefore you can get access to what's happening on the exchange ahead of what is communicated nationally through this mechanism of what's called the SIP, the Securities Information Processor, which is a Reg NMS name, basically, the modern version of the consolidated tape. With co-location and enriched data feeds, we feel like high-frequency traders are getting a leg up that nobody else can meet, because they're essentially starting the race ahead of everybody else. The second element, which both Michael Lewis and Scott Patterson discuss, is that there were many more complex order types developed by the stock markets, by the exchanges, that really are meant to serve high frequency traders. And institutional investors and other less sophisticated traders would be implicitly at a disadvantage if they didn't invest into how to use these orders. So both co-location and enriched data feeds, as well as the development of special order types, they're all seen as tilting the playing field greatly to the advantage of high frequency traders.
So in a sense here, this has nothing to do with the technology per se. I mean, technology is obviously part of the picture here, but it's actually to do with the fact that the exchanges have themselves created structures or services. They've offered services to people, to high frequency traders in particular, that allows them to exploit the speed advantage, to conduct that latency arbitrage. And they're getting a preferential treatment relative to other people who might be participating in the market. That's the real core of the concern here.
Yeah, I think technology is just the particular environment in which these practices have developed. But the other thing to note here is that when computers completely invaded and then dominated the trading environment from the late 90s up to the present, what happened was you created meaningful time gaps between the different exchanges. And we're talking usually in terms of milliseconds. So high frequency traders are trading anywhere from, say, 2 or 4 up to 20 to 50 milliseconds, 1/1000ths of a second, ahead of other traders. But those small gaps in time, which are far smaller than a human can really meaningfully perceive, those are very meaningful in the digitized trading environment.
I mean, there's a really good illustration of this actually in Lewis's book. I think Lewis's book starts with the story of this cable being constructed. Is it between Chicago and New York? Am I correct?
Yes. The commodities future trading business really occurs in Chicago, and the stock trading business occurs now in New Jersey, but formerly New York City.
Yes. So they're conducting they're building that cable, and I can't remember the precise figure, but
you're reducing the time it takes for market messages to go from Chicago to New York from about 16 to 20 milliseconds down to about 13.
Yeah, so I mean the actual gain seems to us minimal. I mean, we as you say, we can't even comprehend a 3 millisecond difference or a 7 millisecond difference. But this is sufficient for them to make some serious gains in trading. Like the amount of money that was invested in building this cable was fairly substantial. It was in the hundreds of millions, as far as I recall.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, if you're going to spend $400 billion to do this, and then people are going to sell access, this new fiber optic system, which have now been superseded by microwave technology, communicating through tower relays between Chicago and New York. It tells you that there is a lot of money.
The things that you've discussed here in relation to high-frequency trading, how exchanges are selling services to high-frequency traders that enables them to take advantage and tilts the playing field in their favor. So things like co-location, enriched data feeds. I mean, could you just briefly explain what's an enriched data feed? What are they getting extra over and above what other people are getting?
My understanding is they're getting more granular information on quotes than is provided, again, to the SIP, which is basically the securities information processor is giving you a national best bid and offer. So that's the Reg NMS public institution, quasi-public, that is disseminating the nationally best bid and best offer for any one stock. In an enriched data feed, you're getting data on quotes that are canceled and the time in which they're canceled, so people can discern the trajectory of market prices. So you're getting more granular information that can be used to make a predictive judgment about where the market is going.
There was one other thing that you mentioned, which I can't remember now. So collocation, special order types that are available to high-frequency traders.
Well,
they're available to everybody.
Yes, but they're quite complex, and at least upon their introduction, the allegations are. And actually, the Securities and Exchange Commission did fine some exchanges for improperly disseminating information on their how they're used to the market. They require much more sophisticated understanding and deployment on in terms of the traders that are using them than a normal, the old-fashioned limit orders and market orders, your basic orders. So those orders would be crafted to allow traders to take advantage of certain unusual situations in the market.
So, I mean, those things seem, I mean, you mightn't like what the exchanges are doing, but they're all legal. What they're doing is legal. There are other things that high-frequency traders do or have been suggested that they do that are a little bit more dubious and seem more like market manipulation. So could you discuss some of the things that they've been accused of doing that seem to reach this threshold of market manipulation?
They have been accused of doing it, and in regulatory proceedings as well as a few court cases, they have been found to have done it. So it does exist, and in certain cases it's been prosecuted and people have been found to have engaged in these practices. So it's not a mere allegation. I think the most simple and straightforward example of this was what's called spoofing, and that's simply engaging in market manipulation via computer. And in my paper, I have an example of this. Say the current bid for a stock, so somebody's saying they will buy the stock, a current bid price would be $15.10. The current offer to sell was at $15.14. A spoofing strategy would be to make a higher bid. So to come in and give a quote that says, I will buy for $15.12. The response of other algorithms, other high-frequency traders, or other market participants would be to raise their bids up to $15.11, $15.12. So you've induced people to follow you up in your bid. The spoofer then sells at $15.12, which is 2 cents more than the previous current bid. Then they immediately cancel their earlier bid. So they've faked a higher price in the market, gotten other people to respond to them, and then turn around and sold at that level. And there was a prosecution 2 years ago of a guy named Michael Kosha, who was found to have engaged in this practice. And presumably many people have engaged in this practice, but this was one instance where someone was prosecuted for it. So that is a simple example of market manipulation. What they call layering would just be a slightly more sophisticated version of that, where you're posting, you know, a sequence of prices either going higher or lower, getting other traders to follow you up, and then making the opposite transaction. So selling at your artificially induced high price, for example.
This came up in my interview with Michael Wellman and Uday Rajan, where they commented that spoofing is quite a regular, I don't know if they said regular, but it's a reasonably common practice, and you know, people get charged for it all the time. Is there anything about the technology here that makes spoofing easier to get away with or more likely to happen? Or is it just really that the technology is being used to do something that people were always doing anyway?
My intuition is that it's the latter. It's merely an application of technology in a way that mimics a very old form of market manipulation. That's a good question. I don't see this as something that's intrinsically different because of the technology.
So what we've reviewed.
Do you have a different or has anybody that you know of given a different response?
Yes. So the one thing that people have pointed to is the instability that's possibly created by these systems, because they respond so quickly to changes in information. They can have kind of very high magnitude effects on markets in a very short timescales on which humans can't really respond and react and deal with them.
I would certainly agree with that, but I think there's many examples of dangerous instability in the current markets that are not caused by this sort of activity. And conversely, you could have many, many incidents of spoofing or layering that don't really create any significant larger market turmoil.
Yeah, so I think you can, of course, have instability that's caused through other means, but the one thing that people have argued is just slightly different is just the time scale on which the instability materializes or manifests itself.
Yes. And if you, in the Kirilenko and Lowe article, they discuss some spoofing cases, and these entire sequences of events can occur in 400 or 800 milliseconds. So you could have a legally actionable event or sequence of events that occurred in under a second, certainly.
Yeah, and perhaps the one other thing, this isn't really a difference that results from the technology per se, but it's just maybe the mismatch between legal standards and technology. So people using technology to do things can cause problems when it comes to the application of traditional legal rules around, let's say, market manipulation, where the focus is oftentimes on human intention, kind of mentalistic states, which can perhaps be difficult to apply to the use of technology to do things. Some people have made that argument. There's a much more elaborate set of arguments around responsibility gaps and the use of automated systems in other parts of the law as well, but some people apply the same logic to automated trading as well.
The Kosha case is an interesting case in this regard, because my understanding of that case is that the judge and the prosecution, the judge accepted this view, is inferring intent through programming an algorithm. So yes, insofar as American financial law requires intent for certain violations, the judge and I and the prosecution, I think, are making a very natural inference that if you program an algorithm to behave this way, we're going to infer intent. But in some other types of situations, that could be a much more difficult argument, particularly where you had basically what would be an accident, like the flash crash of 2010 probably was an accident. Well, if you have a massive market disruption and nobody intended, or you might even find it hard to say they acted with negligence or recklessly, how would you assign blame there? But in the market manipulation cases that are more straightforward, I think my sense is judges are making a natural inference that if you program an algorithm to behave this way, we're going to infer intent when it actually does.
I think it'll depend to some extent on how the system is constructed and how it's programmed. So, you know, some people would argue that machine learning type systems is more of a distance between what the algorithm or the machine does and what the human programmer might have intended, and it can be more difficult in those cases. But, I mean, just one thing I would say here is that, and this challenges that argument that I put out there, when it comes to the assignment of blame and responsibility for what happens in a complex social system such as the financial market, it's very difficult oftentimes to assign blame and responsibility. This has been true kind of in the aftermath of the 2008 crash. You know, why did that happen? It was a complex confluence of events. It's very hard to disentangle and locate individual agents who are like clearly responsible and to blame for exactly what happened. You know, it was an emergent product of a lot of complex underlying interactions between people. And I think that could also be true in the case of the flash crash, where it's not human beings interacting with one another, it's algorithms or automated trading systems interacting with one another, but they can have these kind of complex emergent effects, unintended consequences that are quite negative, but it's difficult to kind of disentangle it and figure out who exactly is to blame for what happened.
I would certainly agree with that. And I think maybe that is the larger fear about the current market. I think there's many fears, but the risk of flash crashes and other type instability, that's a much, much greater risk than a few people in trading firms, you know, engaging in specific acts of market manipulation, whereby they might make a couple $1,000s at most from any one incident.
All right, so we've spoken here about some of the specific features of high-frequency trading and some of the concerns that people have about it. But, I mean, one of the key contributions of your paper is to present an ethical framework in which we can analyze and assess and evaluate high-frequency trading. Now, within economics, the typical ethical framework, maybe not always explicitly stated but certainly implied, is basically a utilitarian framework where we look at the net social benefits or consequences of this technology. And some people do defend the use of high-frequency trading from a utilitarian or consequentialist perspective, although consequentialism and utilitarianism are possibly two different things, and I won't get into the technicalities of that right now. So like, what are the kinds of utilitarian arguments that people make on behalf of this?
The basic ones are in the finance literature, where people are saying, when you look at measures of liquidity and certainly spreads, and then you look at what happened to prices as high-frequency trading was being introduced to various markets, you would find increased liquidity or decreased spreads. So from those measures, you can then naturally conclude, well, this new computerized trading must be doing a good thing in general for market participants, and therefore you could infer an increase in what economists would call social welfare.
Just for people who aren't well-versed in financial theory, including myself, I have a vague sense of what people mean when they refer to things like, so this improves liquidity within the market. But why is that deemed to be a good thing? Like, what's the net benefit in terms of social welfare?
Liquidity would just be the ease at which you could sell or conversely purchase an asset. So if I had deep liquidity in a market, it would mean that I might have my one best bid for a stock, but below that I had many, many more lower bids that if I needed to sell a large amount of stock, I could access deep down into the book, I could access those bids. So liquidity is a good thing for people who want to transact because you can do it right away if there's significant liquidity. The spread would be the spread between the two prices. That is generally good because you'll get a more advantageous price if somebody's willing to buy at price pretty close to what the prevailing offer to sell is at. You know, the seller's going to get a relatively good price for their product or asset. So if we say we have increased liquidity and decreased spreads, in general, buyers and sellers will find it easier to transact and to do so at more advantageous prices.
So it's increasing liquidity, but as we mentioned earlier, it's operating at a time scale which is just, you know, well beyond human comprehension. So, I mean, how significant is the liquidity advantage? Or, I mean, is there any evidence for this liquidity advantage and also the reduction of spreads?
The liquidity issue is slightly different than the time scale, and the concerns about liquidity with high-frequency trading are that you could have what appears to be fairly deep liquidity in the book on any one exchange, but if markets go the opposite way, that liquidity immediately dries up. And that phenomenon is similar to what you see in Michael Lewis's book Flash Boys, when they try to make trades and then they experience what's called quote fading. All those quotes seem to vanish immediately. So the liquidity, the issue here I think people are concerned about is that it might not be a real lasting, steady supply of liquidity, but it can vanish in an instant if markets go in a different direction. And the spreads, yes, the spreads I think objectively are much lower. I think the ethical issue surrounding high frequency trading, though, is really that some of the prices are not the true stated prices. And that gets into a sort of global question of what a quote is right now in the markets and whether quotes can really be relied on. The overwhelming majority of quotes now, I believe the figure is between 97 and 99%, are canceled before they can be acted on. So high-frequency traders are putting out quotes, but they're immediately canceling or revising those quotes based on other information they receive. When you look at standard measures of what we would think are health of markets, like liquidity and spreads, another issue might be, are those really relevant to what's happening now in the financial markets?
I mean, 97 to 99% sounds like very high, and it, I guess, indicates the prevalence of high-frequency trading systems in the market.
Certainly. So I think in a larger sense, even though some people posit, yes, there are these benefits to the market, I do think there's also been a sense that there are negative costs associated with high frequency trading. In essence, some people posit that high frequency traders are sort of extracting a rent out of the trading system by inserting themselves in front of other trades, i.e., a kind of front running. It's not legally front running under American law, but it's similar to that. So they're extracting a rent, and that what we formerly believed was a price, i.e. a quote, is not really a quote that can always or even often be acted upon. And that's where, in this paper, I connected this with some ethical theory by formulating a general principle of reciprocity in trading, which you see I develop in the paper, how this goes back to Aristotle and other ethical theorists that say, when I make a trade, what I get in return from the other party is somehow commensurate or equal. It doesn't mean we can't trade on differing beliefs about what will happen in the future, but it in essence means I'm getting something of the same value for what I'm giving up.
You're skeptical of the application of the utilitarian style of reasoning to the evaluation of high-frequency trading systems and maybe more generally. So, like, we'll talk about reciprocity in a moment, but why do you reject the utilitarian approach and move towards this, I guess, a more deontological and even Kantian system?
It's a fairly global problem I have with real utilitarianism, and much of economics, and certainly the American law and economics movement, is adopting what I think of as a fairly straightforward utilitarian frame. And this really, in terms of the narrative around high frequency trading, I think Michael Lewis's book captured this, that institutional investors felt like they were getting ripped off. And if we examine what was happening from their perspective, certainly that's a legitimate complaint. They thought there was a quote out there they could act upon. When they tried to go act on it, the quote just faded away. So if they wanted to make the transaction, it would be at a significantly worse price than what they were told just seconds before was the prevailing price. There's a sense they were getting ripped off. And I do believe from their own internal perspective, that's true. I think if you're a standard economist, you come in and try to look at the system in a very global sense and say, well, is it on the whole, increasing social welfare? If so, that's a good thing, and we should just let it be. However, if you're perhaps a subset of people in that system who feel like you've been deceived, how does that global increase in social welfare help you? And do you have a legitimate complaint about how the system is functioning? I believe you do.
Yeah, I guess that's perhaps what the debate around Lewis's book revealed, was maybe a fundamental clash between ethical worldviews. So you have this rationalistic, utilitarian, globalistic view of the economists who are evaluating this and looking at variables like, well, is it increasing liquidity? Or is it reducing spreads? Is this on balance good for society? And then the question of individuals' sense of fair play, their sense of the demands of reciprocity or fairness, that these are being violated in these trades. Now, like, one of the things that I liked a lot in your paper was how you went into a little bit about the ultimatum game and how the ultimatum game reveals kind of natural human instincts towards fairness and reciprocity, but also how, you know, financial trades occur in a fairly unique social context, which is a very spare social context where we don't actually engage with people really face-to-face. And that's definitely true when you've moved away from the broker-dealer system. It's not broker-dealers engaging with each other face-to-face anymore. It's a very spare social context. And oftentimes, I think the sense of fairness and reciprocity is drained out of that kind of spare context. And maybe that's a problem with the way in which trades are conducted.
You know, and I worked on Wall Street for 5 years. So although it was a while ago now, I do think when you're in that context, you're okay with much sharper elbows than most humans are in their daily life. So I think to some extent, ethics here are contextual. There's a fascinating sociologist, Donald McKenzie, who's written a lot on financial markets, and he says they're the most attenuated of market transactions, i.e. high-frequency trading markets are. So where you just have algorithms intersecting. Nevertheless, Michael Lewis's book showed socially that there's still a certain amount of consternation people feel. And part of my paper is to try to say, where did that come from? And is there any legitimacy to that? I do believe there is. One other thing I would like to say about utilitarianism and general economic reasoning in this context, I think there have been a number of people who've pointed out, both in terms of our financial system in the wake of the financial crisis and now in this context, that our system is so complicated that it's very hard to make causal statements and certainly predictive statements about how the system functions with enough accuracy to really engage in what we think of as a traditional cost-benefit analysis. And if you can't accurately do that, that, in my mind, raises a big question. Is an ethic that focuses on social welfare, is that even a reliable or useful way to understand these problems?
So there are longstanding critiques of utilitarianism and about how you conduct cost-benefit analyses, like the timescale over which you conduct them, what you're comparing relative to what, how you factor in other considerations like fairness into these utilitarian frameworks, if at all. And yeah, there's the complexity of causation. So high frequency trading is a useful wedge issue, I think, into those larger debates, because it's revealing the complexity of this system, the complexity of conducting these cost benefit analyses, perhaps highlight the practical limitations of utilitarianism or consequentialism, however attractive or unattractive they might be philosophically. And then the interesting thing about the Lewis debate and what you're saying about, you know, the sharper elbows on Wall Street is that even though Wall Street is an environment in which kind of thick relations of reciprocity and fairness do not apply or historically have not applied as they would in ordinary commerce or in more intimate contexts or personal life, there is still a sense of fair play on the market. And that sense of fair play is being violated by these systems.
Yes. And one thing I do at the very end of the paper is I try to connect a general principle of reciprocity from philosophy with three more specific principles. The first would be freedom from misrepresentation. The second would be a level playing field. And the third would be institutional integrity. If we look at those principles, which I think flow analytically from a principle of reciprocity, certainly we see historically American law and the law governing stock trading has encompassed those values. So we do find in our law principles that are not, strictly speaking, the same as pure economic principles.
Maybe I could just wrap up then on two questions. And the first one is, so you have those three principles that emerge analytically, as you say, from the principle of reciprocity. So if I remember, it's a rule kind of against misrepresentation, fair level playing field, and the third one was institutional integrity. So
yes.
Is your view that these principles are being violated at the moment in relation to high frequency trading, and what's to be done in response? Those are the two issues I just want to close on.
To the first, yes, I do think evidence shows they have been and to some extent are still being violated with the development of high frequency trading, or rather the development of high frequency trading has shifted the incentives for different people, especially the exchanges in the system, such that they feel even to survive, they have to do things and work with high frequency traders in a way which is in, at a minimum, severe tension with these other principles that are in the background of both our law and ethics of marketplace exchanges. As to the second thing, what can be done? That's something I'm starting to think about again, working on another paper. We had a stock exchange equity market structure committee pose to its members whether we should get rid of the order protection rule, which is, again, the rule that knits together all the different exchanges into a single national market system with one best bid, best offer price. I'm just getting into that debate. It's very hard to know what to do. One idea I think I'm toying with, and I think in different ways other people are exploring, is what would it look like for America, at least, if you had one single computerized stock exchange?
I mean, reducing the fragmentation in the system, or?
Yes, eliminating it. Because you would just, and this is, compare stock markets 50 years ago, where we had a number of different markets across the U.S., all in physical buildings in different cities, to just having one computer server in, I don't know, Kansas or New Jersey or some Chicago that was basically the country stock exchange. So maybe actually the development of computer technology is making this system of having different market centers obsolete. Why should there be many? Why shouldn't there just be one? That leads in turn to many other financial and legal problems. You could think about a monopoly exchange and the bad effects that might have in the financial system. There could be IT and cybersecurity issues if you just had one trading center. Maybe dispersion into the cloud would reduce that. I don't know. But the point is, looked at from the perspective of these problems in high frequency trading, they could all go away. One other final issue that's interesting ethically is, over the past 7 or 10 years, the profits going to high frequency traders have declined significantly. So estimates are that in, say, 2009, 2010, this industry was making between $7 and $10 or $11 billion a year. Now the belief is the community of high frequency trading shops is probably making $1.5 to $2.5 billion a year. So the market may be reducing the rents that high frequency traders are extracting from the system. In terms of ethics, if you're greatly reducing the financial cost of this activity, maybe you end up saying, you know, and this is a utilitarian reason, maybe it's not as big a problem as we feared.
So I think we'll leave it there. We've gone a bit long, but we've covered a lot of ground in this conversation, both on the historical, technical, and ethical side. So I'd like to thank you for joining me for this conversation today.
Thank you for having me, John.